Rebag, your premier destination for luxury resale. Elevate your style with our curated collection of bags, watches, and fine jewelry. At Rebag, quality is our priority. Each piece meticulously vetted and verified by experts, ensuring your investment is nothing short of perfection. Buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Hermes, Chanel, and Cartier. Access expertly crafted and hard-to-find pieces that redefine luxury. Your next investment awaits at Rebag. Get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. That's 10% off the luxury you deserve. Don't miss out. Head to Rebag.com and enter code REBAG10 at checkout. That's REBAG10.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the Two Norris podcast. I'm your host, James, and I'm joined by my good friend, Timmy Long.
Hi, everyone.
Ron is on the deck. Say hi, Ron.
Hi, Ron.
And a friend of ours is in the hot seat today, Olivia Hart.
Hello, how are you?
How are you keeping?
Nervous wreck, but I'm besides that, I'm quite good. Quite good in myself.
You know what? Nerves is good for you. Because it really grounds you and it makes you more aware of who and where you are.
Yeah, oh, I'm feeling every feeling out of me.
Yeah. You look $1 million.
Yeah. Well, that helps. That helps me. The orange is
after bringing a nice little bit of colour to the studio.
Oh, we're so black and white in here.
I was given all the tips to wear something bright against the black.
Very good.
You're friends with Dirren.
I am.
Who's been on the podcast.
Yeah, she gave me the tips.
And I was saying, since we started and any kind of a little show we've had, you've always been there, yourself and Dirren and your group of friends, and that doesn't go unnoticed by me and Timmy.
Good.
And it's great to have your support.
We love all your shows. It's always a little bit different, always inspiring, definitely educational. Do you know, there's you never come away with nothing. Do you know, you'd always come away with something
from
all your
shows. And a bit of crack too.
Crack, definitely. That's one of the highlights, the James jokes and the normal, you know, the normal jokes like that you'd be cracking, like, you know, the nodge off the rock from
just
Everest.
Just a cockney humour, isn't it?
Yeah. And it's lovely. It is lovely.
We enjoy, when James gets going and he's a bit giddy, it's good crack.
Yeah. And you bounce well off each other, don't you?
We know you, but for the people that don't know you, tell us a little bit about where you're from.
So I'm from the south side.
He's
disappointed to know. I'm from Ardenry Avenue on Poleduff Road.
Oh, yeah.
I have lived in the north side on many occasions down through my years. So there's a bit of an Ari in me.
Oh, definitely.
So I was born and raised in Ardenry. The family home is still there today. And it was a lovely park. Did you know there was only about 15 houses in there? All young kids. You had the best of times. Do you know? From making camps now, to burning fires, to kick the can, you know, just a normal,
innocent.
lovely friends growing up. And I still have those friends, some of them today, you know. It was lovely. It was a great place actually to be brought up in.
Siblings?
I'm the middle of two girls, I have an older sister, Gillian, and a younger sister, Michelle. She's deceased since 2015.
And you have a famous granny?
I have a very famous
granny. James just stole my line.
Did I?
Don't be fighting now. Don't be fighting. I'm only settling in now.
I'm mad. Me and the kids, we're going to beg doomies every week.
My mum spotted you a couple of times and gave you lovely compliments, but I won't say it on air. Peggy Toomey. Very proud to be her granddaughter, and she lived with us all her life as well.
You know, for the people, most of our audience aren't from Cork.
Mm-hmm.
Would you explain who Peggy Toomey is and what it means to you to be her granddaughter?
She's a legend in her own right. Mm-hmm. She was a very kind woman, very hard working woman. Her and her two daughters, and actually all the family at one stage, her sons all worked that shop from morning to night. You know, could be 8:30 in the evening and they'd be finishing up, you know, if there was stock there. It was such a shock back then that, the pallets would be delivered outside. People would be waiting for those pallets to be dropped, and literally everything would be bought right outside the shop off the pallets. and it's changed an awful lot to today. You know, now we have to horse the pallets into the shop, and you know, it's not what it was years ago. But yeah, I came from a very strong grandmother, and that was passed down to my own mother. She's a very strong, hardworking person, you know, and that was passed on to my sister. My older sister would be very like my mother, hardworking businesswoman, would give anything a go. You know, she's involved in gymnastics now in Bantry, and she has her own business, the boutique. Shout out. But you know, I didn't, for my own reasons and for my own journey, get into that hard working. Now, I worked down there for a couple of years, and it, like, I love the customers. Mm-hmm. I love the customers. You know, you become friends with the customers
and
down there.
Everybody in Cork City knows Peggy Toomey.
Yeah.
And like, Peggy Toomey's, it's a shop on the Colquay, which is like an old marketplace, and there's so much history and tradition down in that area.
Steeped,
But like, Peggy Toomey's, like, it's like, if you say the words Peggy Toomey to somebody in Cork City, they immediately know who you're talking about, the shop and everything that goes with it. So, like, you must be very proud of that.
Very proud. Mm. And, you know, my mother and my grandmother are, like, kind to their customers, would help them, would give them, you know, like, if it was the addict or the alcoholic off the street, my mother would have a fierce compassion for, like, still, that's all passed down. Do you know, my nan, do you know, the old book, everything, do you know, that was all the first kindness, do you
and
know.
Would you have loyal customers for donkeys who are still coming in?
Oh my God, there's generations now, I mean now elderly, they're elderly now and they still come in, rain, snow. I'd be like, I'd be allergic going into work on a rainy wet day, and like, they'd be an elderly customer. She said, I have to come in, it's part of my day. Do you know, I'm not right if I don't call into Peggy's. And look, her customers have changed over the years and stuff like that, but there's still the old school customers coming in.
Is it more difficult for the shop now with the likes of Deals and Mr. Right Price?
Oh, very difficult.
Yeah.
Like, they've seen, where everything goes pear-shaped. Mm. Oh, what's that word? Recessions. Thank you, James.
Yeah.
They've seen a couple of recessions, and they've never been so impacted as to what they are now. Mm. And especially after COVID as well, you know. Mm. But when they did up that street years ago, you know, it changed because people stopped taking that route. Mm. Couldn't park up and fill up your car with bulk. You could only call down and lift. Yeah. And the warden is always there. So things changed awfully.
It has changed.
Even though they saw through recessions, it's not the same.
It's not, no.
Unfortunately.
The shop when we pass is still the same as it was back in the day. The shop now is probably half the size of the studio here, and you wouldn't believe the amount of food that they get in there.
Oh, geez.
Like, you're talking about how it's going to be passed down to generations, and I'm looking at my small fella, and I know for a fact he's going to be bringing his own kids in there.
Yeah, please God, you know? Let it still be there down the road, you know? My mother's not giving up anyway, that's for sure.
Right, we know loads about Peg anyway.
Yeah,
so let's digress, a bit about, as the fella says.
Let's hear a little bit about yourself and how I was growing up in school.
Well, school, I was always switched off. I was, I suppose, just to say, like, there was addiction in the family, you know, with the parents and stuff like that. And I suppose that caused a fracture and it caused something within me. Now, for my two other sisters were here, we'd all have different experiences. We all turned out completely different from each other. But, you know, it was what it was. And I suppose I was always, like, in my head, I was always somewhere else and I was always escaping. Whether it's with the friends and staying out later than you're supposed to, and in school, I suppose I am intelligent. I'm not going to say I'm not intelligent. I just couldn't pay attention in school, and I was kind of getting into a little bit of trouble here and there, but not major. Do you know, I never was like in major trouble as a teenager growing up. Do you know, that kind of way. I started drinking when I was 12, and just drank like as I felt like everybody else was doing. I was just doing what everybody else was doing. Mm-hmm. You know, we were all having the few drinks and what have you at the weekends, and sometimes you get away with it, sometimes you wouldn't.
Into the cold bath.
Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah.
You'll get in there.
Oh, the chewing gum, the sprays, the everything. Like, we just, sometimes I didn't, sometimes I didn't. And, but I suppose I stopped drinking. I was in a relationship with a fella, Tony Swan. Mm. You would know him, I think, to me. And we were madly in love. I mean, now, for teenagers, we were madly in love. And we were friends for years before that. Like, he would have been one of the boys that would have hung around our park. And we were friends for years and we ended up being together. And it's weird to think that you were so in love at such a young age. But we were. And I got pregnant at 15. And it was a little bit of a secret for a while. And so then I was actually doing my junior cert at the time. My back used to be cracking. Nobody kind of knew. They thought I was just gaining weight.
Did your parents know?
No, not initially at the very, very start. No, I was about 4 months pregnant before. And I was starting to show. And like literally the last day of my exam, my skirt burst, you know. And my mum was after finding out. And I never forget, I went down to the Colquay. I think I was actually in between exams. So I had to go back, but it was the last day. Someone was after squealing on me, cousin. But Jesus, she had to find out sooner or later. I just said, what are you after doing? I said, I know. I said, but you know, we want the baby. And she did give us the options. We had the options of abortion, adoption. I could have gone away to France, to my godmother, to hide out, this, that. I was given every option, but me and Tony were saying we were having the baby. And we were supported from there on then, do you know, by his family and my own family.
Some people, when they're pregnant and they get cravings for food, handy when your nan is fucking biggie doing.
I know,
munching chipsticks. Yeah.
It's handy in one way, but like,
because there's a tap of chocolate in there. Trust me, I leave with a bag of chocolate.
It'd be like a cocaine addict living.
I know every Sunday morning I wake up. Every Sunday morning I wake up and I'm just riddled with guilt because of the amount of chocolate.
I'll tell you, we lived through it. We never stopped eating.
I don't know, is this conversation going to keep going back to Peggy Toomey every so often?
Maybe so, but sure, harm. Who knows?
But we're going back to someone much like.
Yeah, we were very much supported in the pregnancy once we told him how we felt and where we stood with it all. And his family, I never forget his mom and dad. I was standing outside his house then, like, afraid to go in. And I never forget, his mom brought me in and she sat me down and she said, Olivia, people in glass houses can't throw stones. She said, you're not to stand outside that front door. She said, you're welcome to come in here. She said, do you know? And I just... It was lovely. Oh my God, yeah. And I relayed it back to her a couple of years ago and I was on the phone to her about something to do with Jane. Do you know, and it was beautiful, do you know, that sense of acceptance, do you know, and she and understanding.
What was it like for a 15-year-old giving birth? Was it difficult? Were you physically mature at that stage?
I was. Like, Jesus, I'm this size since I am, 15, do you know. We're all fine and tall, great growth spurts in our house. But not the labour. The pregnancy was fabulous. My mum got me a private doctor and she set me up for a private hospital back then. And it was perfect. Everything was perfect. I loved being pregnant. I loved the movement. I bonded with Jane. Do you know what it was? A girl. I bonded with Jane from the womb. Really did. Like, and Tony was talked to the tummy and everything, do you know? And that's 15-year-olds. Yeah. Like, as much as I was drinking up until that point and I was smoking, I stopped before anyone even found out I was pregnant. Stopped smoking, stopped drinking, you know.
Just had that maternal instinct.
Had it from the get-go. So the pregnancy was beautiful. I have very happy memories of it, you know. And when I went in to have Jane then, it was an easy labour. You know, I actually got the epidural. She was the only one I got the epidural on. And she was born perfect to me. And but she turned very, she got very ill within a short number of hours. 17 hours old, she was shifted over to the neonatal in the Erinville Hospital. And that's where they saved her life over there. She arrived there near dead with me, the midwife and my mother. And I suppose... nobody ever explained or told me to a great extent, you know, what happened to her. And I just blamed myself, you know, just blamed myself and carried great shame about it, thinking I did this to my daughter, you know. Like, all I was really told was it was a, she picked up an infection. It could have been in the birth canal, which I felt like, oh no, or she could have just picked it up. And that's all I kind of knew to the extent of it. And it developed into meningitis and sepsis and the whole lot. And she arrived near dead. So that was very tough.
Yeah.
I was 16 at the time when she was born, just turned 16. And she had to be blessed in the hospital. And I never forget my father, my mother, Tony and myself were there because they didn't think she'd make it. And when I looked, like we were all hysterical. And when I looked, my dad and Tony had to actually leave. They couldn't, you know, they were hysterical out in the corridor. I never forget it. Mm. But she pulled through, thank God. Thanks. Like she had a fabulous doctor, Dr. Tony Ryan. Am I allowed to say names?
Yeah.
Through this. Like. Yeah, Dr. Tony Ryan, he saved her life. And the nurses around her, it was 24, like she needed 24, like watching, you know, beepers, this, everything going off. It was touch and go for a week. And after a week, then we knew she'd make it. But I was just told, like, developmentally, time would tell. And she, God love her, she ended up being severely, severely disabled and severely brain damaged from it. Yeah. And down the road, I did the best. We did the best we could. Do you know, she came home, my mum and dad, still very supportive. They built on, they converted the garage into our own bedroom because like that, now my nan would have been living with us, two sisters, three bedroom house. So they converted the garage and everything. And she was sick for the first year of her life. She was in and out of hospital for the first year of her life. And I did attempt to go back to school during that. Because my aunt across the road, very supportive now as well, she offered, you know, for me to go back to school. She babysit, and but it just didn't work out. I had to pull out of school. She was so sick. Yeah.
What was that like?
Tough.
Yeah.
Tough. And it's only now I can kind of talk about that stuff.
You're a child, like.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? It's not. It's hard enough for a child, at 16, having a child, having a baby, but having a baby with so much needs, must have been very stressful on you and your family at the time.
Yeah, it was very stressful. Like I remember, like for the first 2 years, Jane wasn't out of my arms, you know, and she had a couple of head surgeries from her hydrocephalus fluid on the brain. They kept failing, the shunts. So she was either in my arms and she slept in the bed with me for 2 years. But like I loved it in one sense, but it was tough. She had fierce, fierce complications. So many appointments you wouldn't believe, outpatients appointments, eyes, ears, everything. Do you know her follow-up appointments with the paediatric doctor, everything. It was full on. But I had loads of support.
Did you did you find comfort in alcohol at the time or how did that
I suppose a year or two after Jane was born, no, maybe about a year, I started experimenting with ease. Took my first E, puked it back straight right back up. My friend was looking fishing for it.
As you do. Oh, it cost about £20 back then.
It was in the foundry, I'll never forget it. And for sure, I swallowed it anyway again. And that was like, started with the ease, I suppose. Just trying to escape, I suppose, the reality of my situation. And poor myself and Tony started to break down relations. Like there was massive pressure on us when I think back of it. To look at a 15, 16-year-old girl now.
I know.
For her to experience, you know, like, but I just always just gone on with it. And I suppose used drugs to cope, I suppose, you know, on the weekends and stuff like that.
And they do that.
They do.
And drugs actually help you to cope when you're going through trauma like that. And that's what it is. You know, you're going through a really difficult period in your life. And you said it there, like you for a while, you were giving yourself a hard time over your daughter getting sick and stuff. Like, and there's no explanation for things like that. These things just happen. Like, and I suppose when you're that young, you don't understand it.
Couldn't process it.
You don't understand it.
Couldn't process it. Couldn't verbalise it. I think that was my issue, really, is I couldn't voice it. And then down the road, Jane had to go to cope. I think it was from my sister's confirmation or community. I can't remember now, years. It's like, you know, to put years on stuff. But she was going in for one night, but I never remember having a choice or a voice or anything in the decision of this. But I do look back on medical notes now and say, Mom needs respite, Jane needs respite, you know?
Yeah.
And I remember the first night and it's like, this was the hardest part of the whole story. Myself and my cousin Valerie brought Jane up. It was only for one night, she was coming home the following day. And, you know, I suppose there was other children in there with disabilities, some visible. Jane looked perfect, you know, and I suppose it brought the reality of it to me. And I actually passed her. We were given a quick look around and I gave her to the nurse or the staff who was on. And I actually felt like I gave my child away there and then. Like, forever. And then she did have respite after that, say, a couple of nights on the weekend. I can't even remember, but it started as respite. And from that point on, it wasn't because of when she was born or her illness, but from the point of me handing her over into Cope, I thought I gave my child away. I abandoned her and I couldn't vocalise it. Couldn't say I don't want this to happen. Now, I think down the road she would have needed it anyway because it takes three people to care for her now, to bathe her, round-the-clock care. But I just have no voice or no say, I think really impacted me, and I felt deeply, deeply ashamed that my child I wasn't caring for, or, you know, and Tony and stuff like that. And I turned to drugs. That's when I really turned to drugs and I just gave up. It just confirmed to me that I was a failure, that I always felt I was, that there was something wrong with me, do you know, that it was always like something bad happened around me. But, and I always swore I was going to do everything right by Jane, but I was never prepared for her illness, her disability, do you know.
Nothing gets anybody, it doesn't matter if you're an adult of 30 to 40 years of age, there's nothing gets anybody ready to be able to handle a situation like that, you know, and you're young at the time, and you know, you're still in school and you're trying to understand what's going on for you within your own body, all the emotional stuff. And it's really like, I'm here trying to understand it a little bit. When I was that age, I was, I didn't know my arse from my elbow. I know.
But I actually feel I was a bit more focused, including that time, that period, just that period from like age, you know, getting pregnant and having Jane and minding her around the clock. And even you go into autopilot, you know, when your baby's sick and you just keep driving on, you know. I remember being forced to bed by my sister and my mother because Jane never slept. She was so sick. She'd sleep for an hour and she's awake again. They literally said, you have to get a night's sleep, do you know. And they took shifts minding her just to give me one night's break. So it was an awful lot to deal with, even though I just got into autopilot, you know, and just said, I'm going to do this. And I'm going to prove everyone wrong as well, you know, because I was a bit mischievous when I was younger and, you know. And
rebellious and stuff.
You know, but like nothing older, completely out of the ordinary, to any other kind of teenager, you know, hooking up and that's having what we do. Drinks like
that's what you do, like.
Cider.
that's,
you know.
That's what you do. It's not that your intentions are to harm anybody, not even yourself. It's just that's what actually happens. That's how we act, isn't it? And that's how we figure out the world and figure out people and figure out ourselves and emotions and get your heart broken. And
The heartbroken. You know? Loads of experience in that too.
But that's the stuff that takes you out of them teenage years. You kind of grow into the late teens, the early 20s, and you kind of move back to having a little bit of a relationship with a parent and stuff, you know, that you didn't have during the teens.
Because, exactly. You wanted to be anywhere but at home. Like, you just wanted to be out having fun and escaping and loving. Do you know, I loved my friends. I still have brilliant friends to this day. Like, my friends are like my family.
Yeah.
Do you know, I have a great, great core group of friends.
Yeah. And how did your life progress after Jane went into care?
I just kind of basically gave up and I met somebody else that was probably as wounded and sick and hurt as me, do you know. And the wounded are attracted to the wounded, as my mother taught me when I went into treatment one time. And I just got caught up in him and was obsessively in love. Nearly, he was like, I was told in treatment, like, he was my primary addiction when I was going into treatment. Yeah. I said, I told a counsellor in treatment one time, I said, I never said no to him. I never said no to him once in the 7 years we were together, do you know. And she said, Olivia, I said no to him once. Once in 7 years I ever said no to him. She said, what would happen if you said no to him? And I said, he wouldn't love me. So I knew there I did a massive need to be loved feel love, give love. Like, I was all about, like, if I just made him happy, if I just did this, if I just did that, you know, and I was cooking dinners. He had no fucking interest in having dinners, and he wanted to be out and about, and he was wild, and I had to settle down to an extent for Andrew, because I got pregnant with Andrew, and so things had to calm for me, and it didn't stop him, you know, nothing changed for him. But after Andrew was born, you know, and I feel sorry for Andrew, even though he's the reason I'm sitting here, and we might get to that later, but I was afraid to connect with Andrew when I was pregnant on him, because I felt like I left Jane down, and Jane was kind of starting to become residential in Co-op at that time. And I had to distance my, you know, I suppose, cut myself off. You didn't want to do it. I felt like, how dare I have another child and I can't even look after my own child.
And you were going through all this without talking to anybody?
Not a word. No, not a word.
Must have been a lonely place.
And I feel sorry for Andrew, because I suppose I, undiagnosed then, had went into postnatal depression.
Yeah.
I gave birth to him on my own. So he was missing, you know, it was a very unhealthy relationship. And look, there was two of us in it. Now I'm not putting no blame. You know, I was just as unwell and unhealthy, you know. And I remember going to the hospital and giving birth to my own, and I couldn't get through to him. Do you know, 20 pence left on the phone, and we were going up in the lift. It just came on straight away. The taxi man was saying, "Will I come in with you?" You know, things like that, like the loneliness, you know, because I went into shock when I realised, like, I was shaking, and the taxi man was outside, and I was pulling the curtains across me. I couldn't even dress myself. I'm banging and saying, "Please wait, please wait." And I'm saying, "I'm actually in labour." And he brought me down, and I said, "I've no money to give you." No, I gave him a present and stuff afterwards. But he said, "Will I come in?" And I just couldn't ring my mum, because I was ashamed that he wasn't there and he was supposed to be there. And she knew that we shouldn't be together anyway. So that was very sad. Do you know, and I had postnatal depression after it, and drugs continued in my life. And I think for that period, for a few years, saved my life.
What age you had this time?
That age, I was 21.
Lot happened.
Lot, yeah.
Jeez, you're a strong woman.
I know, but you don't think it at the time. You just feel like, I had to box off all these feelings. And I never felt strong. I just felt like ashamed, embarrassed, a failure. They were my feelings of myself, you know.
What was your 20s like?
Oh, like with
Andrew and...
Poor Andrew got neglected. Do you know, I was partying. Do you know, I went into the scene of partying as much as I could party. I would leave. I went to the stage that I was like, not come home, you know, the not coming home, not showing up. But like, that if I said to my aunt, "Can I just run up to the shop?" You know, if I was in her house blood sober on a Sunday at 12, she'd say, "Take Andrew with you in case I'd like it." Do you know, and that's, you know. And it was just about, I had the house, then I was after moving into a house with Andrew's dad while I was pregnant. And so we had that house, and we were on and off all the time. So my house was the party house. I had the party house, so everything, I didn't need to afford drugs. Just, you know, I'd gaff. You know, and poor Andrew, he's seen and suffered and witnessed absolutely everything to the time that I went into treatment. My partner, or Andrew's dad at the time, he went to prison. He went to prison for 18 months. And to please him, and because I was in tatters now from drugs as well, the ceiling roof between the bathroom fell in into the sitting room. I remember just sitting there were people that I was intimidated by. I felt I had to leave him into my house, you know, and I was just sitting there and all these things were kind of coming up for me. And I said, I need to kind of get off drugs. And he's in there now and he'd be thinking about me now. You know, what am I up to? And I didn't want to wreck his head. And I signed up to Arbor House as an outpatient, on an outpatient's program, and that was in 2003. And I showed up weekly, and I did my three things, and then he got out. And
how old were you at that time, Louie?
2003, I suppose. I would have been 23, 24, maybe. Yeah.
Just that's
That's very,
that
very
was
good.
My first taste of recovery.
Yeah.
That's for somebody at that age, like, to understand that they need some bit of help is a massive, massive thing, because at that age, you have the belief, a lot of people have the belief that, oh God, I'm too young. Mm. I'm not good, you know? But like, for you to have that little bit of awareness that you knew there was a problem there and to actually go about it on your own, that's a massive step.
Yeah. I know, what, I know.
What was it like going to Abba House? What were you doing? Like,
group work. And to be there, I know I was there, but not there. Do you know, that kind of way. And I started attending meetings, but I was running in and like a nervous wreck, you know. I was going to the meeting, I was sitting down. You could smoke in the meetings back then. I remember, like, it was so long ago, but I had no voice. I couldn't open up. I couldn't talk to anyone after the meeting, before the meeting. And then it kind of started going to a stage where I was pretending I was going to the meeting, you know. And sure. But like, I suppose something still sticks with you, you know, even though I kind of was running in and out and all that. Like, I knew there was somewhere that you could go to. Do you know what I mean? That was about as much as I kind of grasped. But as soon as himself was out, then... not that he ever put pressure on me. He was, you know, delighted that I was off, because probably didn't wreck his head either when he was up there. But he never, like, said, right, we'll start drinking now. It was never like that. I made the decision. He was home and social life came with it, you know, out and about and stuff like that. And I didn't want to feel left outside or excluded. So just started drinking straight away and taking coke. And
isn't it mad how people can get addicted to people?
Yeah. Mm. Always a big shock to me, James. To find out that, for that to be said to me in renewal.
And some people put their recovery as well based on other people's, on other people being in their life.
Yeah.
So, and I know it's my own experience, because when I was in prison, I was waiting for the phone call of Nicole to say, do you know what, Timmy, jog on. You know, we can't do this anymore. I'm bringing up two kids here on my own. I can't deal with this stuff anymore. You'll have to, we're finished. And I used to base my recovery on that, because I wanted to go back using, you know. But thankfully, it didn't. And today, I live my life in recovery for me, because I love it.
Mm-hmm. That's why they say in treatment centres as well, like, don't get caught up in relationships or in cliques, then all of a sudden your recovery now is dependent on somebody else.
Yeah.
And if they fail, you're going to be flat in your face.
I know.
Putting people up here on that pedestal, somebody that's in recovery, you know, because I've often heard fellas saying, do you know what, if he ever goes back in the drink, I'm going back too.
Oh, that's very common,
You know what I mean? Like, that kind of talk. When I hear people saying things like that, I think, there's something wrong here.
Recovery, a very personal journey.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
It has to be.
Mm-hmm. It's different for everybody. Like, I wound up, I'm now in a current relationship for the last 6-7 years with somebody that's in recovery, and it's frowned upon. But now we go back years as friends since 2011. And ended up getting with each other then in 2015, a couple of months after my sister passed away.
Okay.
Like, it doesn't work for everyone. If I'd done it in early recovery, I probably could have relapsed or whatever. But when I finally got clean, I stuck by the suggested things, you know, and all. You know, there's loads of suggested things to do. When I was ready, I was ready, and I gave it everything, you know.
Yeah, it's just early recovery is where you want to be careful with. When you get stable in yourself, by all means, go for it. When you're in a better place yourself.
When the work is done, you know, you're able to make a decision based on how you're feeling then.
Exactly.
But in early recovery, you're not basing any really decision. It's more of a lust thing, you know, because you still have some of the behaviours that you're carrying from your own.
Yeah.
When you're caught up in addiction and stuff like that. So, and that period of your life, he got out, you're back drinking. How long more did it take before you
I suppose we got into heroin not long after that. And the following week, it was crack. And I loved the crack. I still love it to this day. I couldn't even watch it on telly. I really couldn't now. And but I needed the heroin to come down off the crack. And I went to kind of to levels of stealing from my family, my mother especially, robbed her blind. And I'm ashamed to say it, but I did. And
it's
I acknowledge
normal.
It now.
That's normal.
I created kind of havoc, really. You know, I was keeping a handle on it for a while, tipping away off it. And I had this thing like, I'm not going to get strung out with this at all. I've got this kind of like sussed, you know, do it like 3 nights of the week, you know. And then it became to like, you know, get 2 rocks, 1 bag to come down. And it just escalated the amounts and the
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Quincy, and then I remember we were at a christening. There was drink involved. It was after shedding stones. Like, you could not imagine me now 8 stone. You know, like, just, I was faded away. And I remember waking up the next morning and crying to Andrew's dad saying, I think I'm sick. I think it's after happening. Do you know what a panic? Then the race is on then. Do you know, to get it every day. It's all I thought about. Money, robbing, drugs. Money, robbing, drugs, money, robbing. And had to, and I loved the crack. So I had to have that and the couple of bags. That's why I kind of got strung out, because, you know, I just had to have the couple of bags to come down off the crack, or else I was loopy. Do you know, this kind of, like, you see on telly, like...
Manic.
How fast did that actually happen? Like, from the period of time where you started just having this small bit here and there on the weekend or whatever, to actually being strung out?
I'd say about 3 months.
Jeez, that's fast. Like, that's, that is it, like...
Did you have access to a lot of drugs at the time?
No, but money, I was stealing a lot of money. Yeah. I was like, happy
when you have the money.
Because, do you know what I mean?
When you have the money, you have access to whatever you want.
Do you know what I mean? When that was caught, when I was cut out of that, things became very desperate then for both of us. And like I say, my poor Andrew was just brought along for the ride and saw everything, that poor boy. He was like the decoy, shoplifting, flat screen. Huge flat screens. I was going in shoplifting. They wouldn't even fit into the trolley. You'd have to place them across the top of the trolley. Like, it just had to be done, like.
Because I walk out the door with it.
Like, literally walk out the door. I'd be walking around and pulling the bug off. Like, it was like a bow. And it's beepy. And I'd get it off and I'd put that somewhere else. And Andrew would be the decoy and, like...
But that
I'm being caught shoplifting with him as well.
That is typical behaviour of someone that's strung out.
Just you do what you have to do.
You do whatever you have to do. Like, we've all done that.
The shame and the guilt afterwards is when you're thinking about it. And you think, how the fuck could I do something like that?
I tell you.
When you're in it, it's just the blinkers is on. You need the money to get the drugs.
It's the feeling.
That's it.
It's just how the feeling. You need that feeling to go. Because you can't handle the way you're feeling. There's only one thing can do that. Yeah. That's the drug.
Drug. So powerful.
Unreal.
It was absolutely...
How did it come to a head?
It came to a head. I suppose breaking up with my son's dad was the first part of my journey of getting clean. My father passed away on 27th of July 2006. And it was the first time I really needed support and help with Andrew, to go to the funeral, to be there. Like, my father was on life support for a couple of weeks and he was of no help or benefit to me. And look, he wasn't able, and I had to rely on other people. And my uncle, like, when I was being up and down to the hospital, was saying to my mum and Gillian, like, she is expect, like, to know, can you not see? But I suppose with everything going on with my dad and everything just going on, well, life and me being absent, you know, and running away.
It's easier to just turn a blind eye.
Yeah, so I just, a few days afterwards, then I just made up my mind, in this here and now, one of us are going to die. And I couldn't kind of really forgive him for not giving me the help with Andrew, you know, to be available for the funeral. Like, he was asking me for, to get him a bag. After my dad, like, was just buried. And here I am leaving, you know, to run down to give him his, and, you know, and he couldn't help me anyway. I just couldn't kind of forgive it, couldn't get over it. And I said, if I don't get out of this, something bad is going to happen. And it took me a year and a half then of flying solo, getting into all mixed up, bad trouble, charges. You know, I never had a charge in my life until I broke up with him. Like, I remember a time in my own house, like, crack was a big thing for me, as you know. So, like, there's a fella, like, with a guy, this all out my Andrew around, gas mask on, ammonium, fingers of coke, like, washing it up in my kitchen. You couldn't even go into the kitchen, the fumes. Another time, fella, got robbed, basically, and I got blamed because I was the easy victim because the others were fella, and the, like, he didn't want to fight the fellas. And I was kept hostage in my own house with Andrew for like 2 or 3 days. They tore the place asunder. There was big debates about who took it. And I never forget it. They gave me a couple of lines off, they gave me a smoke off the crack. And that was all they gave me and kept me there for the couple of days, strung up to bits like that. When I think back at that kind of stuff.
Yeah, that's fucked up shit.
Do you know, because they knew you'd want more after the first. Yeah. Do you know what I'm talking about? And when I look back at that and I say, did I really experience, live through that stuff? Like, do you know?
You say, how did you survive it? We all think of things like that in our lives when we look back at our lives and saying, there's definitely a purpose for me being here because how in the name of God did I survive this life?
Yeah, I still, like, I was given 10 lives, I'd say, car crashes. Do you know, I could do 10 podcasts on the consequences and the stuff that I went through, but I suppose getting to recovery, is it? My Andrew, I kind of had an awakening moment when I was living in that house now, and I just said, like, do you know, obviously Jane was in residential care by then. And I said, if that happened to me, what would happen to him? Do you know, where would he end up? So I reached out for help to my family. Now, they found it very hard to deal with me being on the fucking receiving end of my addiction, my robbing, my everything, the shame that I was even causing them alone. And they called upon a family friend who was in recovery, and she, thank God, intervened, you know, a little bit of intervention, because she could speak to me without emotion. And she said, this is the story now, Liv. There's a bed there for you in Brewery. You'll be there to detox. You'll move on to Coomera Finance. It was just after opening up the women's treatment centre. She said you 24 hours to think about it. Do you know, probably said more now, but that was kind of the gist of it, straight out. 24 hours later, I said, yeah, I'm willing to do what I want to get clean. And off we went. She drove me and everything. And I went down and this blondie woman came into Rory. She was helping out around the house. She said, when did you last use? And I said, this morning. She said, OK, I'll be back in 2 minutes. So off she went anyway. She said, Olivia, she said, we don't detox people for heroin here. And I went, oh, shit. So off we were sent, you know, sent packing. And then Mary, who was helping me and driving me, she said, Olivia, have you anything stashed at home? Because being in recovery herself and being an addict herself, she knew, like, I needed a fix fairly soon. And I said, I've not. And I said, I was doing it, like, you know. So she brought me to doctors, got me sorted. She was fuming that, like, that place couldn't take you when you really wanted to.
What year was this?
That was in 2007.
I think I was up in Brody that time.
Stop. I was in my Finney.
Vincent.
I was in with Vincent. Tony O'Brien.
Vincent O'Brien. Vincent, I was up there with Vincent. I'd say it was in 2007. Vincent completed that a few times. But I went through the detox. I was in the detox in 2007. But how I got in was exact same situation as you. I was, you know, addicted to heroin at the time, but they didn't do a heroin detox at the time. They don't know. And so I just said I wasn't taking heroin, I was just tablets. So the GP knew in there, the doctor knew. He says, just no heroin. And I says, no. I just smoked that morning, so I was bright as a bee. He says, that's grand. He says, I'd see you in 2 or 3 days. Came back 2 or 3 days later, I was in an awful bit. He says, I says, look, I'm here now. And he just gave me one, a few D10s for a few days. And But it was, I remember it was a January, and in Brory is fucking cold.
Yeah, freezing.
It's an old building, isn't it? Very cold. I never forget the cold up there. After a month, started to feel a little bit better. Cured, left, and relapsed on the day.
Yeah.
But that was my Brory story, anyway. But it's a little bit better now, I think.
Yeah, oh, definitely better now. But like, I made my way back. Yeah, absolutely. I made my way back. My sister took me to her house down in Bantry. Like, I had lots of blessings along the way, as much as I had kind of hardships, you know. She left me come to her house in Bantry in the middle of nowhere. It was actually Kale Kill. And literally stripped me of everything, phones, keys, everything, and literally wore a dressing gown for a couple of days, you know, with the big pockets, tablets, everything in there, and let me do the detox there. And I drank wine to help with it, because they didn't know how to kind of medicate you back then. To help you, like my local GP, like the family GP didn't anyway, do you know, so...
Heroin was relatively new at that time in Cork.
That's like 14 years ago. It was only like, you know.
It's only coming in at that point.
It's only coming in, really, yeah.
To the extent there is now.
Absolutely flooded now. Jesus Mary, it's awful. But and as soon as I got a urine clean, I went straight back to Brory and did the, they gave me, even though I was clean as a whistle going in, went on the usual detox and went to Fernanson. And when I came out of Fernanson, I think it was like respite for me, you know. It was just like Olivia on her own, kind of getting to know herself, having a bit of crack with the girls. You know, I was like, Mom, I think I really needed this. You know, when I was get the one phone call for 15 minutes a week, you know, I had to be incoming and everything. They were so strict. And I thought I had it, you know. I thought I was paying attention and things were sinking in and everything. Well, 3 months anyway, I left. My sister picked me up, Michelle. And just as I got out the gate, the fear.
I know, it's a horrible everything feeling, goes, isn't it?
Oh my God, the head was spinning. I was nonverbal, I couldn't even speak. Everything was racing. Well, I don't know where I was going back to, what I was entering into. And went home to stay with my mom for a few days. Poor Andrew was in the care of my mother, fair play to her, for those 3 months. And I couldn't go. I just couldn't cope. I did try and ring into the treatment centre. I think I might have gotten one meeting, but within about a week I was in relapse, like, and everything that I hadn't lost, which were only material things, and I couldn't give a sugar about them, but all the not yet, Andrew ended up in social services. He ended up in the care of his father and his partner at the time. She fostered him. And then they weren't able to care for him anymore, and he ended up in the HSC with the social workers, placed him with foster family for a couple of months. And then he also has a disability, Andrew, an intellectual disability. He'd buy and sell you. He's a character. He came to the table quiz the other night. He thought, here he was telling everyone, I'm going to the Tunaris, I'm going to the Tunaris. Like, he loves dancing and being out and DJs and stuff, like. And I said, the poor child thinks he's going to a disco or something, or a rave, a quiz. No, he enjoyed it. Yes, could he come here tonight? I said, it's a different kind of night now tonight. And what was I saying there?
When you got out, you spoke about that fear.
Oh, God.
But that fear is paralysing, isn't it?
Crippling.
I remember that fear early recovery, the magnitude of the task ahead of you.
Oh, it's
like,
my God.
What do I think I'm
facing life without your crutch, if that's the right word. Facing life and without any.
And you don't have the security of the treatment centre bubble.
Or to give up your friends.
And the people.
Friends.
And you're going in.
Who am I without my friends? Where will I go? Who will I be with? I just couldn't grasp it. So forward on, 6 months later, I gave it another go, back down to Gillian's. My sister to detox, thank God, and was climbing up windows, nearly rode off her car trying to escape. I was doing a bad one that time. Just spent a lot of time over the toilet bowl puking. But got there with this. Like, I was literally at that point, at that detox, I was locked in the bedroom in a job. You know, if there was nobody there to supervise, I was climbing up windows. I could do then because I was 8 stone. But I wouldn't be able to climb up now. But yeah, thank God for the support of family. You know, they were all there for me.
Is that it then?
Went back then, and I, because of behavioural things like I was carrying on with the boys, not carrying on, it was kissing or anything, but you know, writing the letters, you know.
Yeah.
I was just, you know, I've a need in me for like, and all I thought I had to offer was, you know, my outsides, flirting, and so I was kind of just getting in trouble for that stuff. So as punishment, they told me I wasn't going back to Fernand's, and I was to do my 3 months on the detox floor, which is a bit of a killer now.
Is that a separate part of the actual treatment centre?
Detox is separate,
Detox, and back in that day, the detox for the men and the women was both in Brorey.
Okay.
And the women was on one side, the men was on the other side. But passing notes is very common, isn't it?
Very. I still have notes from Vincent. Oh, he cracked me up. He was like, oh... Like, it made it a little bit easy, we used to talk to each other out through windows, late at night, I'd be in the smoking room and he'd be in his actual room.
You know, every evening at 6 o'clock, to do the Angelus, you know, to stand in the corridor and to do the Angelus. Vincent used to be there doing the Angelus, now in Irish.
We knew it off by heart.
But I tell you one thing, I laughed my way through my time up at there with him.
Yeah, I did too. That was actually 2008 for me with Vincent, just making me clear, you know, because I actually spent the 3 months in there and he spent, you know, so that's why I spent so many times. Oh,
some character, wasn't he?
If I even showed you the letters, I drank my tears on him, I really did. But it was still hard, no and all, like, as much. But you know, his dad watched. He's a distraction at that.
His father, Teddy, watches the podcast, actually.
Oh, I know. And sure, my mom used to come down to the family days with his mom, and you know, there was a connection there. And
his mom passed away there recently enough, Teresa.
I know. Around.
Nice family.
Ah, sure, I know Pete as well, and I know a couple of the sisters and stuff like that from when we used to be down in Yall back in the day, do you know. It's mad how people kind of come back into your life later life, but
How did, do you know, that was the start of recovery, and we all know what the start of recovery is, how it is, you're getting to know yourself, you're getting to know trauma, you know, stuff's coming up and you don't even know what it is, the feeling, the emotional aspect of it, all the fear, the shame, the guilt. How did you manage to get through all that? What kind of people did you have in your life? You know, what did you do?
Well, I suppose that third and final time, I was 100% that I was going to give everything to this, do you know, besides the mess and own brewery and all that, like, and sometimes wanting to leave, but I had nowhere to go anyway. I was homeless. The council took the house off me, wrote off the car, blah, blah, blah. So I was like, as much as I wanted to leave there sometimes, I had nowhere to go. And I said, like, this is actually better to be here than anywhere else, you know. I was kind of homeless, really, you know. But I said I was going to give it everything. But there was always something, I think you touched on this as well, Timmy, before. I always thought there was something else wrong with me. Do you know, so I said, all right, I'm going to prove now, I'm going to do everything here, and I'm still going to fuck up in some way. It's not going to work. But it didn't happen. I spotted a fella that used to come back for the weekly meetings in Brorey, the men's meeting, and just linked in with him as soon as I got out of Brorey. I stayed in my sister's house for the 6 weeks because my mom was kind of done with me. She wanted to wait and see. Not done with me now, like, she was...
She just needed to see where you're real.
She was done with... Yeah, exactly. Yeah, she was there 100%.
Because she was after being hurt so much.
And I was after trying so many times.
A lot of false stands, like...
Yeah. Exactly. And I don't blame her one bit. So I went to my sister's house and I was doing the check-ins weekly with Renewal. And I was going to 2 meetings a day. Sure, I had no clue of what was... how to live a life. But I was just going to these meetings, making new friends, hanging around coffee shops. And that was really it. But I had to be so aware of, like, every street I walked. Why am I walking the street now? Like, my awareness was so heightened because I did not want to fuck up, like. And I didn't want to go back. So I would check myself, you know, or you'd be scoring this, that and whatever. Like, I had to check myself on everything. What street I was walking, why, where, everything. So I was hyper vigilant about my recovery. I really was. I gave it everything. I put in the foundations. Then, you know, I had the 3 months in Renewal. I got another 6 months then in Sober House, and I had a choice.
Sober House is a house where people in recovery go to.
So it's a 3-step phase. Okay. So you do your primary somewhere, then you get into Renewal. Now, it's all changed now, James. Yeah. Fellowship and Renewal are one now, and it's mixed.
Yeah.
But back then, it was 9 women. and Fellowship has an old
aftercare house for women up across from Vincent's.
Yeah.
Right. That house on Blowney Road.
Yeah, bungalow.
Yeah.
And it was a treatment centre in itself. It was secondary treatment centre is actually what it's called.
Then people graduate from that.
Yeah.
And live in sober house.
Sober house, yeah. And it was the first time I started actually being told I was doing good and I was doing well. And I never forget it. Like, I had a counsellor initially there, and she was missing for 2 weeks. Say she was on holidays, and I was in with Eileen Crosby. And she said, Olivia, I'm telling you now. She said, there's no work to be done with you. She said, your guts are on display. You're on the right road. She said, if I see you going off track, she said, I'll let you know. She said, but for now, keep doing what you're doing. Well, I was like, the relief to hear that I was actually doing something right for the first time in my life. I was putting the work in, and that just helped me so much, just to hear those words. Do you know, I never heard it out of Brewery because I was a bit of a messer and wanted the laugh and the distraction. So that was the first positive time. You know, it was like I fucking got A's in school or something. Yeah. You know?
You're getting a bit of praise.
I got a bit of praise. And it just had such an impact on me. And I felt like I was a good role model for the other ones coming behind me. Just, and I loved it. I tell you now, if they had a place where you could go back for respite, kind of like treatment as well. Like I often said to Eileen, you know, because I stayed in touch with them all throughout the years. Like I would run to Renewal years later, like, you know, about my sister dying. Mm. Or like I've often run up there. Do you know, it was just a kind of like home.
Yeah.
But I came out of there with a choice of counsellors, my own pick, to follow on with my counselling, and I chose Audrey, and she's still my counsellor to this day.
That's a long time ago.
14 years to this day.
And Audrey is a fan of the podcast.
Audrey's a massive fan of
the podcast. Hello, Audrey.
Hi, Audrey. Yeah.
We'll have to get you over to sit in the studio one day.
Absolutely. Yeah. Oh, she'd love it. I actually wanted her to be here. I really did. But she's even helped me so much now. I told James in the last three weeks with my nerves, and I suppose, not about my story, because my story isn't my story and it can't change, but like to not be hurt people in the process of my story, the filtering.
Yeah, mind yourself as well, innit? Like.
You know, so I hope I'm doing all right that way.
We didn't.
Yeah.
And we didn't, you know. I think you're very mindful of other people. You're mindful of where they may be in their own lives.
Yeah.
I think you are.
Yeah.
And there's no blame and not anything.
No blame. Oh, my God. My own decisions all the way. Never. You know?
And that's very important.
Yeah, that was the most important thing to me coming here, was just not to hurt anybody's feelings, basically. Do you know?
It's like early on in recovery, do you know, when you go into a meeting and you say something and she afterwards, you shouldn't have said that, right?
I know.
But here, you're more mindful and you've more understanding of the consequences of saying things that you shouldn't be saying. And it's like, do you know what? You say your story, you say it without hurting anybody, and you still inspire people at the same time, because you're giving them a direction as well.
Yeah.
You know, they'll listen to your story and say, do you know what? If I do this first, you know, and that's what it's all about.
Yeah, and I've said it before, like when I was asked to go on the Tommy Turner show the first time, I declined. Mm. It was for the exact reason. I don't want to hurt my mum. I don't want to hurt my dad and my siblings.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, no, I won't. And when I did it the year later, when they came back again, I asked permission, basically. I said, look, I'm going to give my story. It's going to come up. This stuff's going to come up. The last thing we want to do is hurt people or blame anybody.
That was the only nervous thing I had really about coming here. And I'm not a great speaker, like publicly or anything like that. But yeah, just didn't want to hurt anyone. Do you know? And Audrey, like that now helped me. And she saved my life. I've lost myself so many times through recovery. Beginning with my sister. You know, I was 6 years clean when my sister took her own life. January 2015. And
what age was she?
She was only 26. 28. She was 28 at the time.
Young woman.
6 months of a snowball deterioration, psychiatric tablets. I never understood mental health until Michelle died.
Mm.
I never thought she was going to die. Even though she made attempts on her life nearly weekly, it was just total chaos. But I never still thought she was going to die. And
You don't. Because you're looking at the attempts as in, like, you're looking at all the attempts as in something, just a cry for help.
Yeah.
And you think that they'll keep doing cry for help.
But I suppose never. Because when they always survive, you think, like, when Vincent died, Teddy rang me, and I was in the College of Commerce, it was in early recovery, and I was like, come over, like,
yeah,
people love us all the time, and come over, like, and then when he didn't, it was like, fucking hell.
You get a fright, yeah.
Yeah, because we're not expecting it, like, and I'd say it was like that with Michelle.
Oh my God, it was the biggest blow ever in my life, even to wait to go in to see where she killed herself in her own house. It was like an eternity. And there's nothing like laying down on the floor with your dead sister and your mother on one side and me on the other side. I'll never forget it. Like, she shouldn't have died.
No.
She shouldn't have died.
Sounds like she was bothered.
Another fracture in the family. Like, so, when she died, we lost her children too, to an extent. Because they went with both their dads. And, like, we had, like, you know, it was like a big family unit. All of a sudden, it's just like me, my mom, Gillian, and our kids, you know. It's
tragic on a lot of levels, like.
Yeah. Massive. And tragic for them too, poor children. Do you know what I mean?
Like, for you at the moment, these days?
For these days, I suppose I'm finding myself again, James. I lost myself after Michelle died. Wanted to die after Michelle died. Audrey helped me through all that. You know, I was lucky. I was getting lots of counselling back then. And because of COVID and finding out that I wasn't responsible for my daughter's illness and disability, I only found out 2 years ago that all she actually needed was an antibiotic within a couple of hours, and it wouldn't have gone so bad. And I got that news during the start of COVID in serious lockdown with Andrew, who's an utter and needs to be on the go all the time. He's so funny, like, he's gas.
He's
such a people person. They call him the Lord Mayor of Cork. He's 22 now.
Hi, Andrew.
Oh, hi, Andrew, baby. he's gas. Like, do you know, they say, like, it takes a village to raise a child. That's what I've had with Andrew, because he's bored with me and Justin at home. Like, Andrew would have one or two Bulmers, feel like. We don't drink. Like, there's no drink in our house. So he potters around. He's known by everybody since he was in primary school to know. I just had, like, say, a parent-teacher meeting, and he goes to a hub and he's a little part-time job in the Harp on a Friday. And he's, like, he's a legend. Everybody knows him. But from primary school right up to, like, 2 weeks ago, a meeting about him, they were like, everywhere we go, somebody knows him, Olivia. I said, I've been told that all my life. He's just real.
Like, he's not full a piggy. Of
life. Yeah, yeah. I tell you now, full of life, popular character, and just loves to be in the middle of everything and having a ball. But he's an amazing child.
Should bring him down someday.
Oh, I will. Sure, he's fans now. The two Marys. How can I go? But, like, I suppose I'm getting into a better place. Do you know, after, I suppose, I realised I was grieving all my life and had to box off my feelings around Jane, and the shame and the guilt, and not to be able to do everything for her. I only told Audrey everything, like the nitty gritty of all the details of, like, what came afterwards, bloody blah, the feelings, like, to talk about the feelings of feeling a bad mother, failure. She only, like, I'm with her 14 years and I'm only telling her last year, like, I held it so close, so deep. And she was crying. She was crying. I looked over and she was crying. But just kind of dealing with the...
She loves you.
She does. And I love her. I love her. I'd be lost without her. I really would. So I'm just trying to get back now to getting... finding myself again. Restrictions have lifted. COVID crucified me. And all that information coming back about Jane was very hard to process. And lots of connection. I need connection. I'm a deeply connected person. I need something to look forward to. I need to be seeing my friends all the time. Like, Zoom and on the phone was no good for me. And thank God for Justin. Like, he was a massive support throughout all of that. Like, he took as much time off from work as he could, because I think I had a breakdown. I still not fully recovered, like, you know, just to comprehend what I carried and blame myself for all those years. But I'm working through it. I'm working through it. I have a fantastic network around me. I have a little mini fellowship within the fellowship, and do you know, people like, I'm you a people person. You have
some fantastic people in your little mini fellowship there.
My doctor's amazing. I love my doctor. I have a new doctor since I got pregnant on Shay. I have a new little boy, Shay.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Congratulations.
Our recovery miracle baby. Do you know, did I ever think that would happen?
Fuck.
You know, and he's adorable. He's a, do you know, he's a pure four-year-old little messer and everything, but a pure character. And I got his, do you know, he's finishing preschool now, so they gave us a little report on him. Oh my God, the tears. Like, it was just all lovely stuff they said about him, like, and I couldn't be so prouder. Like, I got another chance to be a mother in recovery, because, like, I suppose all that was important to me, coming from a fractured home, I just wanted to have a normal family life. No dramas, no violence, no nothing. You know, just a calm. Like, we're never going to get it perfect. I don't think I'm going to get it perfect with Shay either. He'll grow up and do his own thing too. But just to be in a place to give him security, do you know?
Yeah.
And that he knows when he comes in from school every day, there's certainty. Do you know, there's no uncertainty in his life. He's mollycoddled and he still sleeps in the bed with me, and Justin's in his bed in the bunk bed.
The boys though, they're different. Mammy though, different. Aren't they?
I prayed for a boy though. Yeah. I did pray for a boy.
Boys
now.
And the boys are a different story.
Oh, unreal.
All he wants is his mommy. Now Justin's unreal with him.
I'd be getting jealous with the relationship my wife has with my 10-year-old.
Yeah.
I'd be pushed aside. Like, if me and him are having a lot, me and him, we have a bit of crack. She never takes my side.
I know.
Like, I'm getting brushed over there. Like,
I know that.
I walk in from work and there's your man sitting down having his dinner fried, and she up over him and she looking after him. I'm saying, where's my dinner? You make your own dinner.
Oh, stop, I know.
I'm only joking, she'll kill me over that.
Flip around the office, yeah.
No, she looks after me too.
Ah, she does. You wouldn't be going on this long if you weren't caring for each other and minding each other.
Talking about having a partner in your life, and I know James is the same. Like,
yeah,
we're just blessed to have the people we have in our lives today, because they're the people who make us keep going.
Absolutely.
You know, and they give us belief in humanity. Yeah. You know, and because they teach us about friendship, they teach us about love, how to be kind.
I know.
You know, and I'm blessed to have the people that I have in my life today.
Yeah.
You know. And Jill, sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
And Justin's an excellent communicator. And I'd be telling Audrey, I said, no matter how many meetings or how many sessions I have with you, I'll never be able to communicate as well as Justin. Mm. He is, he'll name it there and there, do you know, and then. I could fester for a week and hold on to something. Like, if you said the wrong word to me, this is going back a couple of years ago in our early relationship.
Yeah.
And like, we had a lot of work to do. I had to do it myself, and he was in early recovery of a couple of years ahead of him. But like, we were going back since 2011 as friends anyway. But he's some communicator, like, and he'll just name it and he'll want to, don't you know, just this, talk about it now, forget about it, blah, 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 move on. And do you know,
that's good.
Jillian is a bit like that. Huh?
She's
very forward. Like, if there's something to be said, like, she'd be very assertive that way, which is good. You know, you stand with people, not festers. You get over it and you move on with your life.
Oh,
you know?
God, I could carry it for a week.
I know. I'd be a little bit.
Like, you put up an awful time with me at the start.
I suppose if you're doing that, then like, it's you're going down the passive aggressive route, and you're kind of caught up in your head, and you're not feeling well, and
you're carrying resentment. Then,
so it is the right thing to do.
What if?
100%, but like, now I can like talk and say it, or I'm upset about that. But
takes us time, though.
Do you know what we fight over most? Food. I tell you now, we have so little fights or arguments or, you know,
he's a chef.
Disputes.
Is he?
No, he did do the air and chefing, and it just, do you know what? He was just too old getting into the game, I think. Yeah. That's something you have to kind of
read. Does he carry them skills into the home? I'd say he'd be a great cook at home.
He's
like,
brilliant. He's absolutely brilliant. And he'd help, like, he did a communion party. Now, he'd help out anyone now. Mm-hmm. My sister's communion was at her my godchild was at the weekend. It was a lovely distraction from the two narries. And you know, he went out and helped with displaying all the food, and like, great help to her. Now I swear, she said she would have been lost without him. Like, he's just pure hands on, gets on with anybody. It's like, I don't have to even think, is Justin all right, can he hold his own? He's a pleasure to go anywhere with.
Brilliant.
Do you know, he's a great old, I'm actually blessed.
Well, he's blessed too.
Oh, yeah, Justin. Hi, he's Justin. Fans as well.
And everybody.
Yeah.
It was, listen, it was lovely talking to you.
Yeah, thank you.
I remember
you know, when I was in early recovery, we used to go to meetings together and stuff. But I always looked up to you because you were a couple of years kind of ahead of us. And, you know, you always was very classy and very glamorous the way you are now. So I feel like I had to get to know you a little bit better here because I didn't really know a lot of the backstory because you'd be quite reserved in your sharing, you know. So
and I was buried then as well. A lot of my story, the backstory, you know, I couldn't talk about it till I was ready. Do you know, I think everything happens at the right time and unfolds at the right time. And here we are.
The timing is right now.
Yeah, absolutely.
From all the other people that I've spoke to, like what NNA, they have always spoke very highly about yourself in the meetings and stuff, and your story and how you are and how well you're doing, you know. And I think that says a lot, you know. And sometimes we need to take that and have a bit of pride for it as well.
It's good. I spoke with a fella today. I work with drug and alcohol service, and this fella's in the depths of it, right? And I said, I was in the depths of it. No, my reputation was, you know, scumbag, junkie. These are the kind of labels. But now I'm somebody that's respected in the community. People come to me for help. Mm. And your reputation is everything, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And your reputation is brilliant.
Oh, thank you.
So that's great. It's like, no matter what, nobody could ever say anything bad about you because you're a good person. That's all you can be. Just be a good person and help the other person coming up behind you. So
that's it. Yeah.
Great talking. Yeah.
Thanks very much.
Thanks, pleasure.
Thanks so much.
Thanks
so much. Thank you.
And we'll see everybody next week.
Thank you.
Slán. Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.